You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Ukrainians from around the globe are in Bucharest for the summit of the Ukrainian World Congress, and the Paris Olympics will go faster, higher and stronger unless you're a drone operator. I'm Guy Delaunay. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at the Dory House in London. I'm Guy Delaunay. My guests, Julia Lasitsa and Claudia Jacob, will discuss the day's big stories. We'll also be getting the lowdown from the Delphi Economic Forum and keeping an eye on the time in Geneva at one of the world's biggest watch fairs. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. It is, as I said, the Monocle Daily, and I am Guy Delaunay. And today I'm joined... Now, Julia, I said at the top of the programme there, I pronounced your name... I didn't get it right at all. I said Julia Lasitsa, which is neither one thing nor the other. It's neither the full anglicisation, nor is it the original Slavic. So do you want to give us the full skinny on this?
Well, just that, I guess, like lots of people whose families moved countries, the name is sort of made up. It should be the Polish... version, original version is Wasitsa, which is very difficult for English people to pronounce. So then we just removed the accents and it became Lasica.
Yeah, this reminds me of the American footballer who I always want to pronounce Christian Pulisic, you know, living in the Slavic region as I do. I mean, that's exactly how I would say it. But he himself has insisted to commentators he wants to be called Pulisic.
Yeah, well, that's actually quite...
It's an odd one, that one. I am myself very used to getting my own name mangled, Delaunay. When I was growing up in Liverpool, of course, it's a fairly Irish city, so everybody was convinced I was Delaney, not Delaunay. But then, of course, if I'm ever in a French-speaking country and I start to spell out my name having pronounced it Delaunay, after a few letters they go, ah, Monsieur Delaunay.
Exactly. Well, that's how I first read your name in my head when I saw it, Delaunay, like Sonia Delaunay, the artist.
Exactly so. And we were talking about Robert Delaunay earlier, although my sister said Sonia was the better artist.
Oh.
And she only got the name by marriage. So I cannot claim any of, you know, direct family ties. So that's obviously devastating stuff. But as we said, I mean, your name is obviously connected with the region, and we are starting with Ukraine, because there's a big event for the diaspora kicking off today. The summit of the Ukrainian World Congress is taking place in Romania's capital, Bucharest, and as well as hosting Ukrainians from around the world, there'll also be diplomats and political leaders at the gathering. Well, I'm delighted to say we're joined now by Kurt Volker, the former United States Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations. Welcome back to the Daily, Kurt. Just first Thanks. Of all, for those who are not familiar with the summit, how significant has this event become, would you say?
Well, I think it is important for the diaspora community, especially as Russia's full-scale invasion has played out. Ukrainians all over the world are deeply concerned about what's happening in Ukraine. They're trying to find ways to provide humanitarian support. They're being very innovative about trying to provide defense support as well, things like investing in drones. So it is a way for them to take stock, to hear from experts, to coordinate their own efforts. And it gives them a fairly substantial voice that governments around the world, where they have substantial Ukrainian diaspora communities, pay a little bit of attention.
And in terms of what's happening right now, we've been looking at the situation with Ukraine, with NATO, the European Union. Will that be being discussed, do you think, at the summit? Ways in which the people could help Ukraine in these membership negotiations for both of those bodies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. First off, everyone there will be completely committed to seeing Ukraine a full member of the European Union and of NATO as quickly as possible, because they're quite convinced, and I think they're right, that's the only way to assure peace and prosperity and security for Ukraine in the future. What I think is also true, and this is less talked about, is that we're going to have a problem more broadly with European security, security of the European Union, security of NATO members like the Baltic states, Poland, Finland, unless there's peace in Europe as a whole. If we don't have peace in Ukraine, we run the risk of a wider war in Europe. And so that's a message I think they're going to be talking about and taking back to the capitals of the countries where they are coming from, that we need to look at this in a much broader context.
Great. Thank you so much, Ambassador. It's Julia here. I just wanted to jump in with a few more questions as well. Picking up on your last theme there, talking about how allies, what the broad implications of this war are, I wanted to ask also about how do you think that allies, drawing on your diplomatic experience, how do you think military allies of the US, like the Philippines or Taiwan, are looking on now with what's happening in Congress and what's happening with aid to Ukraine from the US generally?
They're looking at it with a bit of alarm because they fear that if we do not have the resolve to stand up to Russia when they're attacking one of our friends in Europe, they wonder whether we'd really have the resolve to do so in Asia if someone were to attack them. Very interestingly, you had the premier of Taiwan writing an op-ed making exactly this case. He wants the U.S. to provide support to Ukraine as quickly as possible. That's the best message for deterring China. And then we had the Japanese prime minister in Washington the past couple of days, and he gave a speech to a joint session of Congress, very much his message as well to Congress. Please pass the aid to Ukraine because we need to show strength and deter aggressors, both Russia and potentially China in the future.
I'm just going to jump back in here, Kurt. I know Julia wants to follow up on that question, but I also want to follow up on what you were saying about security in Europe and the importance of security for the European Union. Haven't we got a rather difficult balancing act here at the moment for the European Union? If it's looking at bringing Ukraine into the fold, it's got to accelerate everything with, in particular, the six countries of the Western Balkans who've been hanging around for ages to get in, because the danger is if Ukraine and Moldova have an accelerated process, then these countries in the Western Balkans might, you know, not to put too sharp a point on it, feel rather cheesed off and maybe go looking elsewhere for fellowship and allies, and perhaps not the places that Brussels would like them to look.
Well, I'm not sure that they really have a better alternative than being part of the EU. And the fact is that they have taken years and years and really not gone in depth in the sort of reforms that the EU has demanded. If they fail, if they are not doing well as countries, that's not going to be devastating for Europe. It's going to be devastating for them. On the other hand, if Ukraine fails and you have Russia taking over Ukraine and now rebuilding its military might and threatening other countries because Russia wants to rebuild the Russian Empire, that is going to be devastating for Europe. So I think it should be both and. We should have an inclusive vision of building a secure, prosperous, peaceful transatlantic and Euro-Atlantic community. But I don't think we should hold Ukraine hostage because countries in the Balkans might feel cheesed off, as you say.
Thank you, Ambassador. And to move, and because the stakes are so high, people are looking for creative solutions to solve the deadlock or to at least bypass the deadlock. You've talked in the past about reviving Lend-Lease. What would you recommend to the US leadership now? How is it possible to bypass what's happening in Congress now and help Ukraine?
Well, I don't think we need to bypass it. I think we need to get Congress to approve the package of assistance for Ukraine that's already on the table. It's about $45 billion worth of military assistance, sufficient for the rest of this year, and about $16 billion worth of economic and humanitarian support. That should move. Some of that may be converted to a loan, the budgetary support part of this. That's something that Republicans in Congress have talked about. I wouldn't have any concerns about that. As long as the money moves, we can talk about whether the loan will be repaid or not later. But let's get the money out the door. In addition to that, though, so not going around it, but on top of that, I think Congress should be looking at authorizing a Lend-Lease package of hundreds of billions of dollars so that we don't face critical gaps in the future the way we are facing a critical gap right now. If Ukraine needs to borrow some money and put that towards its defense capacities, why not? Why don't we authorize that? It's exactly what we did for the UK during World War II.
I think Julia and I have similar concerns about what we also wanted to ask you, Kurt, and perhaps I can put this all together in one go, if you don't mind, which is you know, we've obviously got an election year in the US with the possibility that Donald Trump may be re-elected and the possible consequences of that for support for Ukraine. And also the question of what the leaders in Kyiv need to be doing maybe between now and then to ensure that they've got a contingency plan in place. What's your view on that?
Well, I guess several things are all embedded in that question. The first thing is that European leaders, Western Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, and Ukraine should be doing everything that they can to prepare for the future anyway. Like, no one should be sitting around waiting to find out what's the United States going to do. They should be looking at how do we strengthen Ukraine's defense forces? How do we help them reorganize? How do we increase defense industrial production? How do we get defense spending as a share of GDP up above 2%, maybe to 2.5? These are all things that should be happening anyway, regardless of what happens in the US. And if you look at the scale of the European economy versus Russia as an example, there's no way that Russia can outspend Europe on something if Europe puts its mind to it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is nobody knows what a future Trump administration, future President Trump would do if elected. He has not said much about this. He said he would end the war in a day, but he hasn't said how. It's making an assumption to think this is going to be a catastrophe and therefore we have to start thinking about catastrophe. You simply don't know. No one knows. I would point out that in his first time as president, it was President Trump who lifted the arms embargo on Ukraine, provided the first Javelin anti-tank missiles, closed down the Russian consulate in San Francisco, which was spying on Silicon Valley, was very tough on Nord Stream 2 and on the German government for that. So I wouldn't make an assumption that he's going to be soft on Putin trying to give away Ukrainian territory. But regardless, even if that were to happen, or if it's not, the best thing for Europe to do is make plans now as best it can, given the situation we already face today.
Kurt, many thanks for joining us on the Monocle Daily. That's Kurt Volker, the former United States Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations. That Ukraine World Congress summit, that started today, that's running for 3 days in Romania's capital, Bucharest. Now, if you're in Ukraine itself, then energy is one of the big issues, has been really since the start of the invasion. It's certainly rather acute this week because Russian missiles have targeted and indeed destroyed many of the country's most important power stations. Russia's President Vladimir Putin claims it's a legitimate response to Kyiv's attacks on Russian targets. Now, Julia, you've got personal links to Ukraine. What are you hearing about the situation on the ground in terms of this very much this energy issue?
Yeah, absolutely. So yesterday morning, the attack on a Kyiv thermal power plant, which supplies most of Kyiv, Cherkasy and Zhytomyr, that happened in the early hours of yesterday morning. My relatives didn't hear it because they do live relatively far away. In fact, all of my relatives who are scattered around the suburbs of Kyiv and our friends in the centre, no one heard the explosions, but they will feel the effects because now Ukrainians are being asked to ration their energy use. They are understanding that the country has almost certainly run out of air defence. So there's this tension hanging over the fact that they know now they're not as protected as they were even a month or 2 months ago. And they're preparing themselves by buying power banks, generators. They're kicking back into action any kind of wooden stoves that they might have. So my family, my close family is super lucky because they live in a private home. And so they have a wooden stove at the very bottom of the house, which heats the whole house. So they're very, very lucky. But we have family friends who live in apartment blocks in Kyiv who do not have the same luxury. And so they're finding out creative solutions, you know, to survive best they can.
I mean, people have had 2 years. They must have known that, well, more than 2 years, and people must have known that the crucial infrastructure like this would be targeted probably on a regular basis by Russia. Have you heard, what sort of creative solutions have you Have you heard, have people been frantically installing, I don't know, just something which came to my mind, but would people have been installing solar, for example, as a response?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the projects that's happening now is Ukrainians are doing a mass call out for mobile kind of boilers or mobile solar panel stations to get smaller villages, for example, connected to electricity, because lots of hundreds of thousands of households are currently without electricity in Ukraine as of this morning. But also, I mean, there are other solutions. This isn't the first time this has happened. In fact, last time, 50% of Ukraine's energy was power stations were destroyed in last winter. And then we had people that we knew putting up tents in their flats so that the air temperature would increase by at least 2 degrees, you know, when it was freezing cold outside. I know my uncle, he's building wooden portable stoves made of iron, which he, for example, sent to his brother, who is serving in the army, because he also didn't have access to electricity. So, you know, this isn't just affecting civilians like my family, but they're also affecting our relatives who are all in the army and who are fighting.
If you've got these crucial pieces of infrastructure which have been destroyed, I mean, is it possible for Ukraine, for the authorities, to rebuild them or repurpose them somehow, you know, bearing in mind there's every chance that once they do, they'll be targeted by the Russians again?
Yeah, absolutely. So today, the director of Trypilia, the thermal power plant that was destroyed yesterday morning, he said, what is the point in rebuilding if we don't have sufficient air defence? And we also know that it will take years to... because these are such unique structures and because they cannot be created outside of the country, they have to be created by manufacturers within the country, knowing the certain parameters and needs that have to be met. This is a very long task that will take years and years to complete.
And again, just in terms of the labour, you're thinking about that as well, that, as you say, everybody's, you know, most able-bodied men are involved in the fighting. So where are you going to get, you know, the contractors from, the skills necessary? Where are those people right now? Are they all at the front, or are there crucial infrastructure workers who are, in essence, in reserved occupations?
Well, that's true. You know, there is still a large percentage of men who are not on the front line because of the mobilisation laws that were being passed very slowly. But I can also say that, yeah, this is an issue. Manpower is a huge issue that Ukraine is having to deal with. This is why there have been all these controversies surrounding the mobilisation bill that they were trying to pass.
This is, as you said, it's something which is affecting your family personally. Is there anything that you and people like you, we were talking about the diaspora, the Ukrainian World Congress, is there anything that you can do, you know, from where you are remotely, to support people when they're in this sort of situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Fundraising for the armed forces is a really important part of what we have to do. Depending on which country you live in, you will do the research to find out what sort of weapons the country is able to provide for Ukraine. So, for example, in Germany, lots of refugees, Ukrainian refugees and Ukrainians who have been living there for decades, they're trying to convince the German government, for example, to provide Ukraine with the Taurus missile system. If you live in the US, Ukrainians have been told, and they are trying to encourage their friends and family friends to do so as well, in their contacts within the country, to reach out to members of Congress who have not yet signed the petition for the Ukraine aid bill to go to the Congress. And that is, by the way, 24 members, among whom are many Democrats, including the Squad, for example. They're being encouraged to reach out to their representatives and try to convince them to sign this petition and get the Ukraine aid to the floor, because the overwhelming majority of Congress does support it. There is a small minority.
Julia, thank you so much for that very personal perspective on what's going on in Ukraine. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Guy Delaunay. Now, every Olympic host city faces a battle to be ready as day one of the Games looms ever closer, and Paris is no exception. It's come up with an entertaining list of last-minute snags which go way beyond the usual panics about unfinished stadiums and athletes' villages. Monocle's Claudia Jacob is here to explain. Claudia, this is an entertaining list. Entertain us, please.
Well, we've got an anti-drone campaign, which seems to be the newest update in this list of gripes as we near the 100-day mark. Thwarting these potential drone intrusions, whether that's due to terrorist attacks or just stunts by activists trying to disrupt the Games, has become one of the most key concerns for the organisers of Paris 2024 as the big day looms. And yeah, they've got this anti-drone shield that they're organising to put in place ahead of the opening ceremony, but there are concerns that it won't be sufficient, and there's definitely a sense that actually intrusions like these are actually inevitable, so it's more about preventing them than assuming that they won't happen.
And what does an anti-drone shield look like?
Yes, well, I was wondering the same myself. I was thinking
you could fly a load of drones around. That might be one way of doing it.
I think it's more about detecting these things as they arrive into the capital. And Macron's been talking about pro-Russia assaults and Islamic threats, and that's something that they're going to be looking to test and prevent. I mean, the French Interior Minister said that they would do 1 million security investigations before the start of the Olympics, but there's really a sense that the drones are the most hostile threat.
I mean, this is the thing. About 10 years ago, I think we had one of the first drone incidents at a stadium on my patch in Belgrade, when some Albanian nationalists flew in a drone with a flag of the so-called Greater Albania on it, and this caused a bit of a punch-up between the players and the match to be abandoned. But at the end of the day, nobody was dropping bombs. And the thing is, we've seen now how even domestic drones can be repurposed and deployed in that matter, and that presumably is the fear of the organisers.
I think that's it, and I think ironically the other sort of worry is that as well as these potential drones coming from coming internationally, there are also threats of like protests within their own country from some of the more extreme political factions, namely France's Labour Union, which is threatening huge disruption throughout the Games on several occasions, and it really presents like one of the biggest logistical and security challenges that the city has ever faced and potentially will ever face. And I think, you know, Paris's reputation as a city is also sort of on the line here. It's not just the Olympics, but people will remember these Olympics for years to come. And so as well as protecting people, which obviously is the focus, there's really a worry about how this will actually make Paris look after the Games are finished.
Well, as someone from Liverpool, I have to say I hope they do rather better than they did during the Champions League final. But that's another matter. Of course, if it being 2024, we've got to speak about the environment. And there's a couple of very sort of game-specific environmental concerns with regards to the Games. No, it's not all about the consumption and, you know, the waste that's produced at the Games. For starters, there's an issue with the River Seine, which, you know, there's an NGO here, the Surf Rider Foundation. They've been sampling the Seine for 6 months. They've stated the river is still not suitable for swimming. I'm presuming that's triathlon we're looking at, is it?
The triathlon, exactly. And at the inauguration of the Olympic Village a couple of weeks ago, the mayor, Anne Hidalgo, and Emmanuel Macron somewhat valiantly vowed to take a dip in the Seine before the Olympics kick off in July. But they could find themselves in choppy waters because some of these samples have found worrying levels of contamination, which could potentially disrupt the triathlon. I mean, the authorities have spent 1.4 billion euros on trying to clean up the Seine. It hasn't been swum in really since for the last century. It's really about making sure the Seine is clean enough for swimming for the Olympics and also for the Parisians to be able to use, because actually swimming in the Seine could be something that counteracts this really big other worry, which is the heat in Paris during August, which is going to be a real problem.
I mean, for anybody who's been in Paris during the summer, they know that Parisians clear off.
Well, yeah, this is en vacances
In the best of times, Parisians clear off, but in the kind of summers we've been having lately, the heat can be really unbearable and dangerous, and for athletes, even more so.
Yeah, I mean, since 2010, apparently France has experienced 22 heat waves, and only 10% of Paris is actually made up of green spaces, which is what they rely on for some sort of light relief. And in terms of the athletes themselves, I mean, the Tokyo Games, I think, were the hottest Olympic Games we've ever had. The Olympic Village for Paris doesn't have any aircon. They say that they've got sufficient insulation and they're facing sort of in the right direction to
good
make
luck with
it all
that.
Work. Yeah, there is a real worry that the temperatures will just be too high for the athletes to be able to withstand. And obviously the Parisian, Paris is very densely populated, and that's a phenomenon that's only going to be exaggerated during the Games. So that's something that could potentially present a real issue.
Well, they do say you can't control the weather, but presumably there must be some, you know, mitigation factors coming into play, some ideas they've got for keeping athletes safe.
Yeah, well, I think during Tokyo they had to move some of the events sort of into cooler regions to be able to prevent, you know, heat stroke and all these things that the athletes were having to deal with. There's a reason, as you say, why Parisians all leave the capital during August, and that's because they go to spend their holidays by the seaside. So,
well, a few short months to go, Claudia. Will you be there?
I would love to be, but sounds a little bit dangerous.
I've done Olympic Games. It's best to watch on TV, honestly. Thanks very much for joining us for that update, Claudia. That's Claudia Jacob there. Well, let's head to Geneva now to hear about Watches and Wonders. That's the luxury watch fair that's on this week. And to tell us more, I'm joined now from the event by Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi. Natalie, welcome back to The Daily. And just as a matter of interest, what are you currently sporting on your wrist?
My wrist, sadly, is empty. I couldn't afford any of the beautiful watches that I've been looking at all day, but I did try some very, very interesting pieces that I would have happily worn.
Well, let's start with your particular favourites, Natalie, because if you're walking around looking for some wrist wear, I'm sure there must have been some which caught your eye and you thought, you know, that's very me.
You know what? I've always drawn to Cartier watches, and this year was the same. I think they've done a phenomenal job in really shifting their watch strategy the past 6-7 years, really putting them very close to the top. I think they're second, and Rolex is the only brand that's above them in the ranking of watch brands that comes out every year. And the reason for that is that they really focus on the design icons that they've had in their portfolio for almost a century. And they've been driving this trend on more delicate vintage inspired watches. So I loved the Benoit, the classic Tank, and they're also really focusing on another heritage design called Tortue, which is more curved. I mean, as the name suggests, it's inspired by kind of like the shape of a turtle, and then they're slightly redesigning it, making it more modern and focusing on it this year. And it was all very elegant and very beautiful pieces.
If you're a brand that focuses on heritage designs to such a degree, like Cartier, and if you think about the Tank watch, which was originally designed and aimed at men, and then as the fashions have changed in terms of the case size that watches are coming in these days, particularly for men, much larger than they were, how have Cartier been reacting to those sort of trends?
You know, they've been speaking a lot about it across the fair, as in the case of Cartier in particular. They've said that they don't really think of their watches are gendered. It's why even when you go on the website, you shop by collection, not by gender. And the way that they think about it now is that bigger watch doesn't have to equal masculine watch, and the same for women. So they're just much more focused on design, on really improving and refining those styles season after season and year after year. And they don't see gender as much. And what's interesting was that they were saying that even the very delicate, intricate designs that are more traditionally feminine, like the Benoit that they launched last year, is actually really popular with men as well.
You've got some brands which feel quite differently about, shall we say, gendered design. So IWC Schaffhausen has been working with Pantone on a custom horizon blue shade for its Portuguesa design, and that's being marketed at women.
Yes, and that's one company that has really focused on the male customer. And what they said is that they do want to change this from this year and then engage female buyers as well, because it is an important part of the market. And then there is a lot of opportunity that they could tap into. So yeah, it's a beautiful design of their most classic style. And in a new color called Horizon Blue. It's patented for them. And I guess, again, it's a very nice, soft pastel blue that could work for men and for women, but they will be targeting women a little bit more this year.
We've picked out a couple of brands there who are among the best known. Is this a case of this particular event taking in the entire panoply of the horological world, Natalie? Are we seeing, you know, boutique makers there as well as the big names?
Across the Watches and Wonders Fair, which happens in one big space near the airport, you mainly see the big brands, the big names. I think it's quite an expense to have presence there, to build a booth, to get your team and customers to visit. So you do mostly see the Richemont, the LVMH-owned brands. But I think slowly, smaller brands are making their way. Just now, actually, I visited the booth of Nomos Glasshut, which is an independent watchmaker from Germany, and they've just for the first time come to Geneva and became part of Watches and Wonders. And what they said is that, yes, it's a big risk, but clearly it can pay off for smaller brands as well. They saw a lot of their designs sell out, and a lot more retail partnerships come up during the week. So it's a great investment for brands, big and small.
Do you get major trends? We talked a little bit about case sizes, Natalie, but are there any other major trends that we're seeing in the among the watchmakers this year at Watches and Wonder?
It's interesting because watches are meant to be very timeless and not associated with trends, but every year something does come up. And this year it is, I think, a lot about watches getting a little bit smaller. It's not just about, you know, a chunky case, a flashy logo, lots of diamonds, that I think that's what brands used to bet on in the past. But now they're getting a little bit more creative. There's always a story behind the watch. Things are a little bit more intricate. And also the vintage-inspired watches are very popular, both at auction and in the primary market.
And in terms of the people you've been speaking to, Natalie, has anybody particularly stood out to you in terms of the quality of what they're doing or the inspiration that they're drawing on?
I was really interested. I just this morning spoke with the CEO of Panerai, which is a Swiss-Italian watch brand, and they really focus on very sporty watches and the world of diving. And he was telling me about all the retail investment that they've been doing, opening shops around the world and trying to meet their customers in real life. But also for some of their most exclusive watches that are limited edition and they come out and there's usually 20 of each, whoever makes the investment and buys those really rare pieces also gets to go on these incredible adventures, from going to the America's Cup to getting Navy SEAL training. So it's really for adventurers, and they see the experiential element as an equally important part of the business as watchmaking. So I thought it was really interesting how he approaches it and how he differentiates a brand like Panerai, which is younger. It doesn't have as much history as some of its Swiss competitors, but yet he found a way to find a niche, to connect with people and build a very profitable business.
It's a watch that comes with a full package. Thanks very much for joining us, Natalie. That's Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi. And now to Greece, where Monocle's foreign desk team have been visiting the Delphi Economic Forum. Over the past few days, they've been talking to ministers, ambassadors and guests about Greece's economic resurgence and its place in the world today. Monocle's Chris Cermak and Andrew Muller have been reflecting on their time at the forum. Take it away, Chris.
Thanks very much, Guy. This is Chris Cermak. I'm here with Andrew Muller. Andrew, we have been at this Delphi Economic Forum now for 3 days or so. This is your second time, my first time here at the Delphi Economic Forum. What has changed for you?
It's a little bit busier than it was last year, I think. Or maybe we've just been unlucky as we've tried to cross the venue at the exact moment that various panels are emptying. So I think it is a bit busier, which is all to the credit of the event, because I think there is an understanding that there is value to being here. And it is quite an unusual thing on the circuit of diplomatic and security conferences. And I think the best way to describe why it's unusual is to talk a bit about where we're sitting. Listeners may be aware of unusual noises in the background, which suggests that we are not in a studio, because we're not. We are sitting outside the venue, looking up at a handsome granite mountain. We can see down the slope to the water in the distance, and there is in the background the chirping of birds, the buzzing of bees, and the whisper of the wind. It's a pretty pleasant place to be, is what I'm saying, but it's also in the middle of nowhere. So everybody gets stuck up here for the duration of this thing and kind of has no choice but to talk to each other both formally and informally. And unlike certain other security conferences we could mention, they don't try to stop journalists from just wandering around chatting to people. It's nice in that respect.
The location is undeniably beautiful. It is also, of course, historic, given the Oracle of Delphi mm-hmm. and all of that. That is not very far from where we're sitting either. It is larger than last year, we can assume, or as you say, I wasn't here last year, but it does feel extraordinarily large in terms of the number of panels, the number of topics as well. They're really running the entire gamut, it feels like, which I wonder if that goes to a little of this question of, now that Greece is out of its economic crisis for the past of 10 years ago, it's almost like it's trying to find itself and its role in a whole bunch of things. They're talking about foreign policy, relations with Turkey. They're also talking about shipping. They're talking about climate change. I spoke to a guy who was on a panel about agriculture and the importance of olive oil. Then I met some young entrepreneurs who were talking about rebuilding the rural economy of Greece and sort of the role they played when other people left, they stayed. So there's such a range of different topics. Do you get this impression too, that sort of Greece is trying to figure out exactly what its focus is right now, where it can make its mark?
I absolutely get that. And we have, as we speak, just recorded an interview with Mario Gavinelli, who's the director of the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, which is a big foreign policy think tank here in Greece. And I did put to her the idea that maybe Greece still doesn't quite grasp its own strength, for all that it is a relatively small country. I think there are probably fewer people living in Greece than there are in London, but nonetheless it has this colossal global imprint in so many respects, not just in obviously, and you refer to the Oracle of Delphi just up the street, Western civilization as we understand it began not far from where we're sitting, but you know, its extraordinary influence on culture, on shipping especially. You mentioned that has come up a lot, and she did say that there has become this received understanding in Greece during its post-World War II economic struggles that this is a small and poor country. But it's not really either of those things. And she did say it is still trying to find its range somewhat. I think that's a fair assessment.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about, partly for personal preference and also because of what you've been doing here at the Forum, is Germany, because this is a place that I lived in for 7 years. I covered the economic financial crisis from Germany's perspective on Greece at the time, from Berlin and from Frankfurt. And being here, we have spoken to a few people. We've spoken to the German ambassador to Greece. You also chaired a panel that was about essentially Germany's role, the Germany's economy. The relationship with Greece is extremely fascinating in terms of how it has evolved compared to where it was 10, 15 years ago. The finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, just released his memoirs where he talks about this time in Greece. And we had the German ambassador talking about that, didn't we? And kind of saying he hopes that Schäuble will be reassessed. What was your impression of how Greece looks at Germany now?
I think it'll be a while before Wolfgang Schäuble is revered with statues and postage stamps and songs in his honour. He obviously was seen as the villain of the piece, and I get the impression from the extracts of his book, which have been pored over in the Greek press while we've been here, I don't think he kind of minds being thought of as the villain of the piece. I mean, most people's memoirs, my own not excluded, are basically an exercise in saying, see, I was right all along, and I think that's what he's doing. I do recommend to listeners who may have formed views about Yanis Varoufakis at various points that they do look the memoir out, because Schäuble is quite entertaining on the subject. But yes, you mentioned Andreas Kindl, the German ambassador to Greece, who was really quite disarmingly candid, I thought, in admitting that, yes, the relationship has had its moments over the last 10 or 12 years and that there is work to do. But he and a lot of people, the people I spoke to on my panel, all did think that the trading relationship, which is extensive between Germany and Greece and never really went away, can become a foundation for an actual proper rapprochement, and that the two countries' relations with each other may not always be entirely transactional.
Just finally, Andrew, I wonder if you get the impression, though, that whatever Greece might think of Germany and what the Eurozone did to Greece, if you will, in the crisis, have they learned from that? Have they emerged from that? Do you get the impression here that perhaps they're happy that they at least went through that to some degree? There's that silver lining of now that they're out of it, they're more competent. They had to go through something like that and now have also a government. You've interviewed Kyriakos Mitsotakis as well, who is kind of has a platform and a way of dealing with populism that many other European nations haven't quite figured out.
Maybe. I mean, it's a case I would be reluctant to make to any Greek person I didn't know extremely well, that there you go, you took the medicine and it worked. Because it was from many, many people here at the time who I have spoken to, not just office holders, but just Greek people who were living in Greece, and the same is also true of Cyprus. At the time, genuinely terrifying. You know, like, people really did worry that their country was going to fundamentally fail. People lost pensions, lost savings, lost jobs. Horrifying period for people to have to live through. The feeling at Delphi last year was definitely that, you know, Greece is back, and I think we've heard an expansion on that theme this year. Whether they're glad they went through it, I don't know. I think there's a tendency for countries in general, once they get through a difficult period, in the immediate aftermath, they just sort of stop talking about it. No one really wants to dwell on it. Everyone just kind of, let's just pretend that never happened. And then maybe 30 or 40 years ago, you start to romanticize it as the good old days. Greece is in between those two things. But yeah, certainly it is in a much more solid, secure and optimistic place than it was a decade ago.
Yeah, speaking of that, also the good old days, it's been 50 years since Greece's dictatorship, which has also been discussed here. But we're going to leave it there for now. Andrew Muller, thank you very much. This was Chris Cermak. Back to you, Guy.
And thank you very much, Chris Cermak and Andrew Muller in Delphi for us. That's all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. A big thanks and a deep breath for my guests, Kurt Volker, Julia Lassica, Claudia Jacobs, Natalie Theodosi, Chris Cermak and Andrew Muller. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Guy Delaunay here in London. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Goodbye and thanks for listening.